Sky News Centre at 5. An employment tribunal's ruled drivers for the cab-hailing service Uber are entitled to the minimum wage as well as holiday and sick pay. The GMB unions called it a monumental victory, which will benefit thousands of workers who are treated as self-employed. But Sam Dimitri from the Adam Smith Institute believes it's actually a defeat for drivers.
The vast majority of Uber drivers don't want to be considered workers. They wouldn't trade the extra flexibility they get from being self-employed, from being a contractor. Uber asked its drivers that. They got a polling company to do it, and they found that 76% of Uber drivers wanted to stay as contractors.
Uber says it'll appeal against the ruling. Police investigating the deaths of two children in a house fire in Birmingham say their father has also been critically injured. The 8-year-old boy and 6-year-old girl were killed in the blaze early this morning. Their dad was discovered in a burnt-out car in Newcastle-under-Lyme a few hours later. This woman lives near the family home in the Hampstead area of Birmingham.
I don't know much of the family because they've recently moved into the area, but my son used to play with the two children, the daughter and the son, and they were lovely children. It was just a total shock.
Elsewhere, it's thought a 13-year-old boy who was killed in a shed fire in Doncaster was fiddling with a petrol engine. The body of the teenager was discovered in Campsall last night. At least 10 terror attacks in Britain have been foiled in the last 2 years. It's also been revealed security services and counter-terrorism units are currently dealing with around 550 live cases at any one time. A plane's been diverted to Glasgow Prestwick Airport after it lost communication with air traffic control. The RAF sent Typhoon jets out to help, and the plane has now landed safely. And Morrison's has become the first supermarket to jack up the price of Marmite since the EU referendum. It comes just weeks after its maker fell out with Tesco over its cost because of the weak pound. That's the latest. I'm Annie Gray.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. After the 6 o'clock news, the Bristol Channel and the Severn Estuary, home to 4 nuclear power station sites, Wilfer, Barkley, Oldbury and Hinckley. But its 50-foot or 15-metre tidal range makes it one of the 2 best spots in the whole wide world for renewable tidal power. The Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, funnily enough, which Genoese explorer John Cabot sailed from Bristol to on the Matthew in 1497, that's the other one. Gloucestershire County Surveyor Thomas Full James recognised the Severn Estuary's tidal power potential over 150 years ago, and his 1849 scheme to generate energy included the first bridge. Also, the MayGen scheme in Pentland on the north-east coast of Scotland uses enormous 400 megawatt underwater turbines and was opened by Nicola Sturgeon in mid-September with very little recognition by the London media, even though it's the biggest scheme in the world. So we do the sums and ask what's best for the Bristol Channel to generate energy. Also, Israel leads the world in surveillance software. But does this give Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli military and the people that design the software a backdoor into the NSA and GCHQ? Also, the old controversy, can MMR vaccines cause autism? US manufacturer Merck, who make this vaccine, are embroiled in controversy also over an Alzheimer's drug. But since a whistleblower, Dr. William Thompson, surfaced in the United States Center for Disease Control, it's becoming clearer that big money is trying to cover up links between the vaccine and autism. So why haven't we been told all about it? Well, the film Vaxxed, which goes into it, has been censored. And also, in the second hour after six, that's what we're going to get. But first, on to our news review after the 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 11 Celsius tonight and dry this weekend. Highs a little bit warmer, 16. Cloudy with light winds. We're getting those southerly winds now, aren't we? Next week, highs again 16. Cloudy with some sunny spells. Next weekend is the 5th and 6th of November. Highs of 10 Celsius and sunny spells. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. I think I'm right in saying, Anthony. I'm not sure. If it's the... I ought to make double sure of this, but it is actually Turn Your Clocks Back weekend. Anyway, I'll just double check that for you. I'm pretty sure it is. But I'm joined now by Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello there.
You are councillor for Cotton, but the Lib Dems didn't do so well in the last couple of local elections, did they? You're slowly coming one time running the city council, but now not quite so many councillors.
That's certainly true, and that was because of national situation, but look at the result in Witney. I think we're on our way back up again.
Certainly as an alternative to the Conservatives, yes. Is that what the Liberal Democrats have always been?
No, I don't think we've ever been against anybody or anything. We've simply had a very clear line of common sense and radical politics, which we've been trying to pursue all the way through.
Okay, radical in what way here in Bristol?
Well, I think we've always led the charge on green, the environmental issues in this country, and have done for a very long time. There's been a very active part of the Liberal Democrats, which is the Green Liberal Democrats, which I've been involved with for a long time. And that, I'm very pleased to say, succeeded in achieving green capital here in Britain. In Bristol, we did all the legwork for that for many years and eventually got that through, for which we're very proud. But we've always made sure that we look at everything in a clear way that's going to be better for everybody.
There were some serious problems with the management of that Bristol Green Capital money, weren't there?
There was, and I'm afraid, as with the budget deficit, which we've now got of a £40 million hole that we can't plug, 29 of which came out of the last administration because they failed to deliver the savings that they actually identified. There were lots of other problems with that administration, which I think will come out in the wash.
One of the things we keep hearing about, oh, there's not enough money for this, not enough money for that. Don't we need to get something sorted here? Because we're constantly going cap in hand to these big private banks in London, and they're saying, oh, sorry, folks, you can't have it. But surely the politicians really should be running things rather than these private bankers.
Well, I think we've only got about 55 minutes left. I would think we probably need several months to actually sort that one out.
What would be your, in a nutshell, view?
I think it's bizarre that we are on the back of something which is meant to be coming from central government about a lot more local power and a lot more control of our own finances. We're actually being told what we can and we cannot do, and that we've actually got to have systems in place to deliver this local devolved power in the way that central government is insisting we do it. I don't think that's really devolved, and it certainly doesn't allow us to use the funds that we generate locally for our own use.
What about the city deal that was signed by Nick Clegg, I think, wasn't it, a couple of years ago, and the Metro Mayor? How does that all fit in? Because there's some big changes going on.
Well, the city deal, as I recall, was actually signed in 2011. Maybe 12, but I think it was 11, and that set up the LEP, the Local Enterprise Partnership, and it started the thinking on the separation between growth and service delivery, and a lot of people would say they need to be much more closer entwined. I actually think that a headlong dash for growth also has to consider the ramifications, what comes out of that. Growth is no good for its own sake. It has to do good things for everybody.
So you're saying that the Local Enterprise Partnership is concentrating on growth and spending public money on making sure there is growth, and the City Council's more doing just delivering services now?
That is, I think that's the way it's breaking down more and more. The LEP has a very great amount of money, and it's responsible for basically creating more growth and putting out the information and the infrastructure and the works necessary to deliver that growth. Bristol City Council, I think, is being left in the undertow of all this and having to do the hard stuff. care and housing and neighbourhoods, all of our street scene stuff and all the other many things that the City Council has to do, the unattractive stuff, which is doing on a massively decreasing budget. And that's pretty worrying.
In the second hour, after six, we'll be talking about the idea of generating tidal power from the Severn Estuary, from the Bristol Channel. Back in 1849, Gloucestershire County Council were doing this kind of stuff.
You're asking me to comment on that.
Why isn't Bristol City Council or Gloucestershire Council or Somerset, North Somerset Council or the local authorities now even thinking about actually doing these kinds of schemes and being behind them yourself? Are you? Okay, what are you up to?
Well, we had to get over the nonsense of the barrier, which was there were lots of local protagonists going for, but when that was put to bed as a one-off thing that was going to actually have a technology that was good for that particular time, but then actually was stuck with it for another 40 years. What is going on with the authorities, and there's a all of the local authorities, and particularly the energy groups around the Severn and the Cardiff Bay, are looking at a much more dynamic approach. I've been involved with this for a long time. I've been to most of the meetings, the annual meetings that they hold every year. And what is coming out of that is trying to see it as a way of delivering a testbed of different types of energy generation. The great advantage of that is, of course, that what we can do is not only export the energy that comes out of it, but export the learning as well. And we can create a centre, a living centre, here in the southwest for increasing expertise and exporting that expertise all around the world.
Well, we've got the expertise. We just haven't got the things going on the ground, the generation of the power. Why is it taking 160 years to do anything with this power? We've got twice a day billions of tons of water coming in and out, nothing being done about it.
Well, I haven't been around all that time, so I can't really be blamed for all of it, but and that's probably applies to most other people that are involved at the moment too. But the fact is that it has been something that's been run with for the last 20 years, at least actively, and certainly in the meetings. I've been a councillor now for 7.5 years. I've been going to the meetings most of that time, and the pace of change is going up. But a lot of this is very much affected by international events, and particularly by the way this government's kicked the bottom out of the boat, if you like, in the way that it's actually created the incentives and the tariffs and the structuring the financing for all of this. It's made it much more difficult for this fledgling industry to go off the ground.
But there's Scots a lot going it. On. The Scots are doing it. They're doing the most advanced tidal power scheme in the world, just the northeast coast of Scotland. And why aren't we just simply doing what they're doing, or even just getting some of the turbines that they're building and bringing them down here?
Well, for the very good reason that there are different types of conditions in different places. Apart from the northeast Scotland, Anglesey is another very, very high key area. We've got the area around the around Cornwall, Devon, and we've also, of course, got the Thames, the Severn Estuary and Cardiff Bay. Each of them has different things. The great thing about Cardiff Bay and the estuary is, apart from the tidal race, which is, of course, massive in the Severn, there is not just tidal energy. There's wave. There's energy which is where lagoons are created, and there's energy created within those lagoons. There's lots of different ways of exploiting all of the sea, tidal and
but
wind conditions in that area.
We're not doing it.
But we are. There's a lot going on around there, and there's a lot of experimental stuff all being tried, and believe me, there is. If you look into the websites, you will see what's going on.
Okay.
It's very exciting.
Take your word for it. Anyway, we'll be talking about more about that in the second hour with environmental journalist Paul Mobbs. As Labour gets fined over the election expenses this week, the Conservatives' election fraud scandal is being ignored. This is Steve Topple in the Canary this week. It was revealed on Tuesday the Labour Party had been fined over undeclared election expenses. Electoral Commission fined the party £20,000 for not submitting numerous expenses from the 2015 general election, including the infamous as Ed Stone, which had the these various 8-foot stone tablets which had Labour's key pledges carved into it. Missing costs were £7,614 for that. Now, we've got fines by the Electoral Commission against the Labour Party, but we've got 31 questions over 31 Conservatives also who have had election expenses submitted for them, which appear to be over what they're allowed. And anyway, they're supposed to tell you everything that they've got. So why is Labour being fined, but yet one Labour case being fined, but 31 Conservative ones not? What do you think?
You're asking me to comment. I simply don't know the way these things work. I mean, I'm a local councillor that reads the papers just like everybody else does, and I wouldn't want to meddle in private grief, really. But there's an awful lot of things that can go on at election times, but they really shouldn't. And I can tell you, I've had a great deal of experience running alongside the Conservative election machine. They have a huge number of people that are involved in this. How they are getting things wrong completely amazes me.
Well, maybe they just spend too much and then they defraud the statement that they send in, and they send that, oh, we've just spent a little bit less than we need to, and then they bury some of the expenses that they've used. Because I mean, there are 18 police forces right now supposed to be looking into these 31 individual constituencies, and of course if there are by-elections caused, if they're voided from last year's general election, then the Tories might well lose their majority. In fact, they almost certainly would.
I think it's a very interesting situation, but we've also got the situation where we've got Labour councillors who have been suspended from the party in Bristol City Council. That is also creating a very weird situation.
So what's
where the majority in Bristol is not actually a majority. So all of these things are what ifs. I don't know what's going to come out of this, and neither do you, but it's certainly something that needs to be struck by the law, and the law should make sure that this is done properly.
Well, it does seem like the police seem to be sort of twiddling their thumbs and not acting. This is nearly 18 months since that general election, still no action.
I think that's a fair observation.
Also, 1994 child sexual abuse witness who came forward later committed suicide, telling his wife he couldn't get over not being believed. This is the horrific case of Gordon Anglesey, which was in the press late last Friday. Gordon Anglesey won a major court victory against The Independent on Sunday and Private Eye, following both publications printing allegations he was a paedophile back in 1994. He sued them for libel, along with Welsh broadcaster HTV and The Observer newspaper. The former North Wales police superintendent won £375,000 in costs. Well, last Friday, he has now, I'm not sure if he's been sentenced yet, but he's certainly been convicted of child abuse. And yet there he was, back in 1994, suing these various media organisations for £375,000 saying that he was abusing children. So how strange is that, that a police superintendent could be successfully getting costs of £375,000 when all the time actually the newspapers were telling the truth about him?
I think this is one that I'm going to duck, to be honest. It's a very, very complicated case. I've certainly seen it, like everybody else has done, from reading the news. But it seems that there's quite some more mileage in this yet. I think we've got some wrinkles to sort out here.
The thing I said at the very start, one of the most horrific sides of this, was during that 1994 case, it was Ian Hislop from The Private Eye, actually, who said one of the witnesses that came forward later committed suicide, telling his wife he couldn't get over not being believed at that trial. So this is a police superintendent who is not only abusing children, but he's then perjuring himself and leading to the people who are standing out telling the truth as abuse victims, then finding that they can't live and committing suicide. I mean, just horrific.
Yes.
Lying. And I'm surprised, actually, that last Friday, actually, I read it in one of the newspapers, just in a little corner of the paper on the Saturday, that it's not had a bit more prominence for a public official to be doing this kind of activity.
Well, I think that this is an indication of all the problems that are going through with the inspection that's going on at the moment into child abuse.
Historic abuse inquiry.
These are very, very sensitive things, and some of them are actually related to other people and long streams of cases, which if you start unpicking one part of it, however legitimate it might seem to do that, then you actually prejudice the other people that are involved in all this in terms of their ability to give free evidence to such a thing as the historic abuse review. So I think some of this is being held back for very good reasons. At least I rather hope that's the case. If as I think you're implying, that it's more evidence of the powers that be trying to contain this, then obviously I would be as concerned as you are about that. But at the moment, until I know the full facts, I think we need to.
I'll give you a few more facts.
Well,
if
sure you
want,
you will.
Anthony, which
I'm
is
sure
from
you
the
will.
North from the North Wales Press, who's been reporting on all this. Horrible that these people have had to endure this for such a long time and being called liars, etc., etc. And the system, the judges then and finding for the criminal and against the victims. Gordon Anglesey was, as I said, a police superintendent, and he was a Rotarian, also a Freemason. In 1976, he joined a Masonic lodge in Colwyn Bay. In 1982, became a member of Wrexham's Berwyn Lodge, and in 1984... joined something called Pegasus Lodge of the Wrexham Freemasons. So you do wonder, because I mean, we know, don't we, that the police often are Freemasons, that whether he's used his Masonic connections to help protect himself, maybe through the courts.
Well, you may say that. I have no greater knowledge than you or any other member of the public on this, and I don't think I can pontificate about it. That would be foolish.
Fair enough. Anyway, Gordon Anglesey finally will be sentenced, we hope, very soon. And also, I would imagine, stand trial for perjury for all the pain and grief and the suicide that he's caused in the past. Home to Bristol, a Metro bus scheme costs are spiralling, an extra £13 million. The cost of building Bristol's Metro bus project has risen from £203 million a year ago.
I wish.
To nearly £216 million, the BBC's learned this week. The report identified extra costs, including removal of protesters. Well, I'm not sure it cost £13 million to do that. I'd be very surprised if it did. Council leaders from Bristol, Bath, South Gloucester and North Somerset are expected to formally hear the news at a meeting today. Metro Bus is part of a wider plan to improve public transport in the region. Unforeseen design changes and ground conditions, along with hidden gas pipes in Bradley Stoke, contributed to the overspend. Now, what do you make of the Metro bus, Anthony?
Well, when I became a councillor 7.5 years ago, Metro bus was always already then the scheme that Bristol was trying to secure. It was so far advanced along its track 7.5 years ago that we actually then were advised that we couldn't really turn it down. That will tell you how long these things take, but it will also tell you it's difficult to predict the costs of something so far in advance before very often all of the detailed work is done that's able to pick all these things up.
Is it going to be worth the money?
I have never been sure of that, and frankly neither of many of my colleagues, but what we were all advised about right from the outset was that it was the last big game in town as far as Bristol was concerned about getting hold of a very large packet of government funding. In fact, as I recall, it was the largest grant of its type for this sort of work, and Bristol in that then and now and probably for some time in the future is one of its major problems. It's going to be getting people around. I think you had problems getting here this evening. I most certainly did on the buses, which were completely jammed up, and we do need some radical way of sorting this out. I do hope that the investment that Metrobus has created will allow this to happen. I'm certainly keeping my fingers crossed.
You don't sound very convinced, Anthony.
Well, I'm not going to be convinced until I see it working. What Metrobus desperately needs to do is to join up South and North Bristol and allow people in South Bristol to work in North Bristol. That's one of its fundamental starting points, because it still takes so long to get from South Bristol to North Bristol that it makes, frankly, working across the city unviable. But the other thing that I seriously hope it's going to do is be good enough to persuade more people to put their faith in a mass transit system rather than coming in by car, because it's the numbers of cars in what is a medieval and Victorian city that are actually jamming up our system and making it impossible for the buses to actually deliver the number of people it needs to get to work.
Well,
one of the
problems, of course, is the Metro bus works themselves jamming everything up.
The works certainly are, and you don't make an omelette without breaking eggs. That's always true. I do think in some places it seems to have worked rather better than would have been expected. I thought there were going to be horrendous problems in certain places. Some of them seem to work, but of course the centre has ever since probably ever since Tudor times has been a problem in terms of everything jamming up, and it's still the case, and it's certainly going to be the case while this work is done. If you're asking me long term, if the centre has the works of the centre will have been justified with the Metro bus, I think we need to give it another 2 or 3 years to see how this is all working. But it's certainly been I walk across the centre, I take the bus around the centre, I've seen cyclists come off around the centre with all the works. It is very fraught.
What we really need is a tram. This isn't a tram, is it?
Well, we very much wanted to do that when we were in administration and taking this forward. We actually stopped this project for a while and went back to the drawing board to do another final check on trams, and it pretty well doubled the cost. And we didn't want the situation to completely break the bank in Bristol, as it pretty well did in Edinburgh with a tram system. And very, very reluctantly, we decided that we could not possibly afford a tram, because the extra cost over the £200 million grant is paid for by Bristol.
What about where the routes go? We've got three routes, really. Ashton Vale to Temple Meads. We've got Cribbs Causeway, which is the one that's causing the trouble on the M32, via Emerson's Green into the city centre. And then a South Bristol link between the A370 Long Ashton Bypass and Hengrove Park. So there are three kind of sections to it, almost sort of legs of the spider that kind of come out from the city centre. I wonder, do you think it's in the right place, and that it's going to... This is going back to that question again, really. Is it going to make any difference? Because this is what we need. We need some kind of public transport which is on the main routes in and out of the city, so people, rather than use their car, can get stuck on a bus which is taking forever, stuck in jams, etc., can get in and out of work quickly.
Look, I think the Metro bus, and as I said, 7.5 years ago, this was absolutely fixed. I mean, all of this was not to be changed. There was one change that was made 3-4 years ago, I think, which was around Coronation Road, Cumberland Road, and that nearly caused mayhem. In a very minor late change at that stage caused... I was actually on the committee that sat on that one, and the legal ramifications were frightful, but that change was made. So that was the only slight change that's happened in the 7.5 years I've been in this, and I can tell you it was designed a long time before that. Don't think of the Metro bus like being like any other bus. It is a spinal bus. It is there to actually take almost strategic. It's a city-wide
bus. Only three an hour?
It's going to be moving a lot of people over major routes, and that's why it gets a clear way to get those people fast, long distances across the city. The interesting part will be how all the other bus services in Bristol respond to Metro bus. When that spine is in place, how will the other bits and pieces actually fit with that imposed new structure? I think that's fascinating. I don't think enough people have actually thought that one through. I think that's the one to watch in the future.
Also worth mentioning, it looks like First Bus, surprise surprise, is expected to win the bids to operate the scheme. And we move on now to talk about homeless children. Now, this is a horrendous story in the Independent yesterday online. Homeless children up by 60% since the Conservatives came to power. Children are mostly being held in temporary accommodation, says John Stone, their political correspondent. A number of homeless children's risen by nearly 60% since the year the Conservatives came to power. That's 2010, the official figures suggest. According to the data collected by Department for Communities and Local Government, there are now about 115,000 children living in temporary accommodation every night. Now, that's not a great... I'm sure most people would point to David Cameron as the person in charge during most of that time. But, of course, the Liberal Democrats were sitting down there with him. So it's partly your responsibility, Anthony.
Well, I don't know how the two streams that you're talking about come together, to be honest. It's certainly true that the number of homeless children has gone up in that time, and I don't know how that happened. Certainly, the things that are coming out at the of the changes since then, particularly in terms of benefit cuts and some of the other issues, are going to drive that figure, and we're already seeing it, making it even worse. In Bristol, we have a major problem. We have a major problem with homeless families, which has gone up amazingly. We have a very severe problem with homeless people generally and rough sleeping. That has gone up a great deal recently. And also, we are spending a great deal more than we budgeted for in terms of dealing with children, not only those children that are in care, but those children that present with particular problems.
I mean, isn't this also partly a problem because people just can't get good enough employment or enough money to pay the rent, pay the bills, that sort of thing? It's two-thirds, apparently, of cases involving homelessness now also involve children.
Yes, that's certainly true. We were talking at our neighbourhood scrutiny commission yesterday, and the night before I had a mock scrutiny commission with the youth council about the issue of the pathways to trying to resolve or to deal with and mitigate the problems with young people and homelessness, and finding ways of keeping them with a roof over their heads. It is a major problem. We now have a new a modified approach to this, which is a sort of a five-stage approach. I'm hopeful that will smooth things out a bit, but certainly we have a major problem with children presenting as homeless. The major way of dealing with it, we are told, is to prevent children from splitting up from their families or moving apart from their families right at the outset. But I can tell you that has certainly been Bristol City's policy since 2010, because I was actually the executive member responsible for it in 2010, and I believe it was the policy at least in 2009, 2008 before that. So we haven't changed very much. We might be getting cleverer at it and more experienced at it, but to actually found a policy on something that we've been doing for 7-8 years already, and presenting that as a new broom is not the way to do it. We're going to need to be a lot cleverer than this.
The government's thrown its support behind a homelessness reduction bill aimed at putting new legal requirements on all local authorities. Actually, they're doing this already in Wales. They have been for a couple of years now, to stop people becoming homeless in the first place. The bill would force councils to find people accommodation if they were at risk of being made homeless within 56 days maximum. It was proposed by Tory backbencher Bob Blackman, backed by the government after some changes to its scope, and will face its major parliamentary hurdle today. So I'll better check that. While I'm doing that, why is it that we're not already doing this? The Welsh have done it, and they're saying actually saving money, taxpayers' money, because once people are homeless and they cost a lot, then a lot of money has to be spent on them to deal with it.
Yeah, it's a very good thing to do, and it's long overdue. It doesn't pull together, I suspect, a lot of the streams of concerns around homelessness. It tackles one particular final endpoint of homelessness, so I think it could have been a lot more all-embracing. But what it also does, it's another thing that government is saying, we believe this should be done, but you local councils have got to solve this problem, and there's no extra money for doing that. But more important than that, there's actually no extra accommodation either. And this is the problem with that, however much we might feel about trying to resolve these problems as they occur, if we don't have the wherewithal to do this, we are already got one arm tied behind our back. When I took over the housing portfolio as cabinet member in 2010, we had 285,000 council houses. That figure has gone down by more than 1,000 in that time, and that's under the right to buy process. That's pretty worrying, because that's one of our major sources of affordable social housing.
Okay,
we don't have that resource
anymore.
What
about the 330,000 or so people who are coming in, migrating into Britain every year? I mean, that puts a massive extra demand on the housing. We simply can't cope, surely.
Well, again, if we don't build enough houses to cope with anything close to demand, two things will happen. Firstly, there will be more and more homeless people. And secondly, there are more and more people that cannot afford the prices that are being forced out of a low supply market. And both of those are going to create, and are creating already, massive problems.
Look, the good news is the ministers have pledged today to meet the costs of the homelessness bill. Government pledged its full and unfettered support for a bill that would force councils in England to do more to tackle homelessness. Bob Blackman, MP, said it was a national disgrace that a single person should have to sleep rough. His private member's bill is aiming to reform the law to make sure more people get help before losing their home. A former housing minister warned that councils would need more funding to fulfil the commitment. Well-attended debates saw MPs from different parties broadly support the private member's bill. It passed its first parliamentary hurdle in the Commons today when it was approved by MPs with no voting against it. The Homelessness Reduction Bill will now go forward for detailed scrutiny. This actually, I think, who needs a pat on the back here? It's Crisis, who drew up this report saying how little it would cost to do this last winter. So well done, Crisis.
But you've got this in front of you. Is the money you're talking about coming down from government going to deal with providing the resources to put people into housing, or is it going to build that housing necessary to house those people as well? I don't believe it is.
No, I don't think it is. I think this is, the idea is to stop people being evicted in the first place.
For sure, yeah. Yes.
That's what
and that is
about.
A low cost, and that, as I've said to you before, has been Bristol's way of dealing with the homelessness problem for a very long time. It's maximising the problem at the beginning, before it actually manifests itself into someone not having a roof over their head.
Okay.
And obviously that makes sense.
UK public finances worsen, adding to Hammond's headache. This is just earlier this week. William Schoenberg and David Milliken in The Independent. Britain's public finances showed a much bigger than expected deficit in September, a setback for Chancellor Hammond as he prepares to deliver the country's first budget plan since the Brexit vote. That's the autumn statement. Investors are already nervous about the prospect of an acrimonious British departure from the European Union, and Friday's figures may limit Hammond's ability to cushion the blow of the referendum result via higher spending or tax cuts. Britain ran a budget shortfall, £10.6 billion last month, 14.5% higher than the deficit in the same month last year, the Office for National Statistics has said. The deficit, excluding state-owned banks, so it's handy that they don't include that in it, isn't it, was above all forecasts in a Reuters poll of economists, which had produced a median projection of £8.5 billion shortfall. Well, they got it wrong again. And this is one of the subjects that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week, with Jeremy Corbyn asking Theresa May, the Prime Minister, about how prepared she was for the Brexit.
On Monday, her friend, the Honourable Member for Broxtow, expressed concern of the automotive and aerospace industries, while the British Banking Association said its members are poised, quivering over the relocate button. Every day, the Prime Minister dithers over this chaotic Brexit, employers delay investment, and there are rumours circulating about relocation. This cannot carry on until March of next year. When is the Prime Minister going to come up with a plan?
I have to say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, I think the fact that he seems to confuse a customs union with a border, where they are actually two different issues, shows why it is important that it is this party that is in government and dealing with these issues. and not his. He talks about the plan. I've been very clear. I've been very clear that we want to trade freely with the in both trade with and operate within the single European market. I want this country to be a global leader in free trade. The Labour Party is against free trade. I want to introduce control on free movement so that we have an end of free movement. The Labour Party wants to continue with free movement. I want to deliver on the will of the British people. He is trying to frustrate the will of the British people.
You want me to comment on that? Well, my goodness, that's people pecking it away at each other, isn't it?
Are you a Ramona too? I mean, he's Jeremy Corbyn is Ramoning there, isn't he?
I think you might guess from my background how I voted in the referendum, but nothing is 100% at any time, and I've never made a 100% decision in my life. You have to balance all the factors, and they're not factors that you can balance equally. You have to give weightings to different things and before you come up with the answer.
So we've had some good news and some bad news this week. We've had good news about Nissan staying and actually even committing more to be manufacturing cars in Britain, but we've also had bad news on the economic side. It doesn't look like the government is they're having to spend much more than they thought they would.
I think that the financial indicators are likely to become very, very wayward for some time. I think they're going to be quite difficult to understand for some considerable time yet. The thing that I think we need to focus on is the faith in our organisations, and perhaps today we heard about the Nissan, and that shows that they're going to keep the faith. I don't know what's been given to them to make sure they keep the faith, but that's where they are. But if we start seeing the slide in other sectors of our industry in terms of people going elsewhere, and we're already, I think, the research industry is very concerned about the losses they're getting from people who are not renewing contracts and who are looking elsewhere, because they're very concerned about their ability to stay in this country and to make a life in this country. And we need those people to support our industries. And if we're beginning to see signs of that fracturing, I think that's the one to watch rather than financial indicators.
Low morale at Avon and Somerset police officers. Are they overworked? Well, this is the annual pay and morale survey by the Police Federation out this week. A 2016 survey of more than 43,000 rank and file officers found that over half of respondents felt that their own morale was low. 84% say the way police were treated as a whole was worse. 71% say the pay and benefits are worse, and 58% say their work-life balance is worse because they're having to do more overtime there or having to stay doing work without being paid. So this is not good, is it? We've got 56% of police officers saying low morale.
Well, it's certainly true at Bristol City Council as well. There's been a huge number of staff that have left, have taken voluntary severance. There's going to be some, I'm quite sure, who will be leaving and not on a voluntary way, because the numbers didn't stack up on the last round. The announced numbers of people leaving didn't match the numbers that actually took the voluntary severance and were allowed to go. So I think there's going to be some people leaving that really, really don't want to leave. And there's not only is there, we still trying to do the same amount of work in Bristol City Council, but there's a great deal of turmoil in trying to restructure many, many parts of the council. That's creating more work, and it's fewer people
aren't councils being abolished? I mean, this is what's happening slowly but surely. If you look at the cuts that there have been over the last few years, in 10 years there may be no such thing as Bristol City Council.
Well, there will be needed the services that Bristol City Council provides.
Tax collecting, council tax collecting, that'll be about it.
Well, there was that horrible suggestion that's in fact all we would end up by doing, and collecting the rubbish. Apparently that was the only thing that all councils would do.
Because the Mayor, Marvin Rees, has said, actually, no, we don't have enough money to collect rubbish anymore. We're going to have to get a sort of big society, people in Easton, to go and get together at weekends and do some rubbish collections.
There's a lot of doublethink being spoken about in Bristol City Council at the moment, candidly, and one of them is that it's all right, we're going to get volunteers to do all this. But in fact, when we went through the rather ridiculous process last year of restructuring the libraries, which all of us knew was completely unviable, but was being hailed by the administration as being the way out of our problems, the answer to that was that we were going to have some volunteers. The volunteers, we then found out, and I believe rightly, were not allowed to do those jobs which had previously been paid. And when this point is made, because we're hearing all the time, volunteers, 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 when this point was made again, and I made it to the interim chief executive, I was told, oh, it's not volunteers we're looking for, it's the voluntary sector. Well, in fact, the voluntary sector actually has a great number of volunteers in it. So I think they're hoping to square a circle which is absolutely not capable of being resolved.
I mean, you can understand why people don't feel like they really want to pay their council tax, since they're getting less and less and less every year for it, in terms of services.
Yes, I think that's a reasonable point to make. But I think that if people had a very clear indication of what services they were getting for what they were paying, and I think a lot of people don't have that clear view, then I think that they would realise that they were getting... some authorities are rather better than others. Bristol City Council is pretty good in most respects, and I say that as a humble councillor, not as somebody that is part of the administration.
And not with your fingers crossed.
No. Here they are. They're all there, uncrossed. You can see them. Nobody else can.
Yes. Yeah, well, this time you didn't have them crossed, Anthony. Anyway, look, there's been a lot of changes. Not just the 1,000 job cuts Marvin Rees has brought into Bristol City Council here, but also in Devon. I think it's Devon and Cornwall. And Christopher Chope also asked a question at Prime Minister's Questions about the restructuring of local authorities down there. They're trying to merge them effectively.
Mr. Christopher Chope.
Mr. Speaker, 20 years ago, a Conservative government agreed that Christchurch and East Dorset councils could retain their sovereignty, independence, and control over their own destiny. Honourable friend, assure the House that the government will not agree to the abolition of Christchurch or East Dorset councils against the will of my constituents.
My right honourable friend is right to speak up for his constituents, and he's also right that there isn't a single model that is going to work in every part of the country. That's why we believe it's important for local people to come together and to determine what is right for them. I know my right honourable friend is trying to build a consensus in Dorset as to what the right way forward is. I think it's right that local people are able to respond to the consultation and that their concerns are listened to.
There's also the same sort of thing is happening in Somerset, Anthony. Councillors in Somerset have launched a High Court bid to stop the merger of two Conservative-run local authorities, one of which is West Somerset Council. This does seem a bit strange that the government are actually trying to foist this onto people where local councillors and local individuals just don't see the point. It's Taunton Deane Borough Council that West Somerset Council is trying to merge with, or at least there's an attempt to merge the two, but a lot of people are against it.
There will be a lot of local feeling, and the people that will feel it most will be those people that have been engaged with those councils for a very long time as councillors and officers and in lots of other ways. Of course there are going to be strong feelings, but councils and many of these organisations are simply where someone has chosen at some stage to draw a red line. line. We've had recently had a boundary change in Bristol, which you will know about. There are some absurd things that have happened
that?
In Bristol.
Where's that?
The whole of Bristol went through a boundary change in these last elections this year in May 2016 were on the new ward boundary changes. And very soon there's going to be constituency boundary changes as well. Bristol itself has a red line around it, which is absolutely absurd. It was probably absurd 25 years ago, and it certainly is today. To think that Bristol actually runs along one side of the Avon and goes and doesn't include parts of its built-up communities in, for example, Filton and Patchway and Kingswood, all these sorts of areas, which anybody would tell you is Bristol. It is so. What you call something is not necessarily how you administer it. And it is possible, I think, to reach out across these red lines and do better works by being sensible about how you can organise.
Isn't it effective? They're just shrinking local government, just as we were saying before. You know, there's less and less and less local government, and it's really big business people with the money that are running things.
I think you're probably, and I've already referred to the LEP, which I think now is an unrepresentative. It doesn't have elections. It's an unrepresentative, pretty opaque organisation, which, yes, does have a very big influence across the whole of the west of England. But the fact is that the local authorities are still doing. They still have the same number, generally the same number of responsibilities. I mean, our responsibilities in terms of education is still there on paper, but in fact we do rather less of that now because of virtually the privatisation of education. Talking
about these boundaries, I mean, the current electoral register, or the one that's around at the moment, apparently, according to some people, are saying that 2 million people are left off of that because of the changes in the way that you register as an elector. There could be around about 2 million people missing from that register. It sounds like the worst possible time to be redrawing boundaries, because most of those people, of course, will be students, young people, or poor people, who are likely to vote one way or another. Surely you've got to make sure, number one, that your electoral register is up to scratch before you start rearranging boundaries.
Well, we've had and I'm not the administration, but I have been to many discussions where we were told that every single household was approached 9 times to try and get the people in that household on the electoral register. And I think
that's emails or what?
That's a number of ways. The first one is by a general advert, and then it goes all the way through to personal knocking on doors on more than one occasion and reach the people.
I mean, if a household or individuals are a bit dysfunctional or vulnerable or whatever, then they may just look at that as something that they can't deal with and simply not do it. That doesn't seem to be democracy to me. Anyway, speeding driver is caught and fined every 12 minutes in the Bristol area. One driver was fined every 12 minutes on average for speeding. Well, it's not that easy to do it in tonight's traffic, but across the Bristol area last year. Police data released this week showed officers in Avon and Somerset dished out 44,930 fixed penalty notices for speeding offences in 2015. I would imagine a lot of these are from the speed cameras. Oh, these new ones, I reckon this is mostly these new ones up on the motorway that are producing this money. And I've even seen on there, very, very cheeky, where you can be driving along and one of them says, say, 50 miles an hour, and you see the next one that says 50 miles an hour, and suddenly you get a 40 miles an hour one. So you have to watch every single one, otherwise you may get caught by one of the... which is a bit cheeky, you know. Anyhow, so... are we doing enough to nab people who are speeding, causing danger on the road, Anthony?
I feel very strongly about the 20-mile-an-hour zones in Bristol, which I think are there to protect, fundamentally, to protect, make safety much greater and people much more conscious of the environment in which they're driving. If I feel particularly strongly about those areas in terms of the way that they're covered in terms of enforcement and catching wrongdoers. I do believe that the speeding in Bristol is declining. I think that in the 20-mile-an-hour areas, certainly. But I can tell you,
in the traffic jams,
I walk an awful lot, and you can sometimes motorists will come like a bat out of hell at you, doing massively more than the speed limit, be it 20, 30 or 40, screaming down the roads. And those people should not just be fined, they should be taken off the roads. They are very, very dangerous.
Okay, let's get back to Prime Minister's questions. Luciana Borgia brought up mental health this time.
Owen Thompson.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure we all recognise the removal of the camp at Cali is not a long-term solution to the ongoing humanitarian crisis. But can the Prime Minister tell us what the government is going to do to learn from the experiences in Cali and to speed up acceptance of vulnerable individuals as it committed to under the Lord Dubs scheme?
Yeah. Individuals are already being brought to the United Kingdom under the Dubs Amendment. That's in addition to the resettlement scheme for vulnerable Syrians that we have, the 20,000 that will be brought to the UK over the course of this Parliament, and in addition to the 3,000 vulnerable people, children and others, who we will be bringing from the Middle East and North Africa, working with UNHCR in all of these to make sure that it is right for the individuals to come here to the United Kingdom and that they have the support when they get here. But I would remind the Honourable Gentleman that it is this country that is the second biggest bilateral donor in relation to humanitarian aid in the Syrian region, and we are able to support and provide for more people in region, and I think that's absolutely the right thing to do.
So do you think that's been dealt with quite well, this getting rid of this jungle camp? I suppose it couldn't stay there forever, Anthony, could it?
Well, I think it was in such a terrible state. If you look at some of the film of this, it is, you can't, I think, accept slum conditions, which you're just nodding as you go by. You have to address it. You either have to replace that with something which is of a reasonable condition for people to live in, or you solve the problem another way. And it would appear that the French government have chosen the latter course, and they're trying to spread the problem around their own country. And some of the unaccompanied children are coming to Britain as well. It's their decision.
Okay, now Luciana Borgia on mental health.
Luciana Borgia.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister just told us that there are record levels of spending going into our mental health services. Her health secretary stood at that dispatch box on the 9th of December and told us that the proportion of funding going into mental health from every one of our CCGs should be increasing. Why is it then that 57% of CCGs in our country are reducing the proportion of spend in mental health? Yet another broken promise. When will we have real equality for mental health in our country?
Well, the fact that I set out that we're spending record levels in the NHS on mental health is absolutely right. But I have said in response to a number of people who've questioned on this that we recognise that there is more for us to do in mental health, and I would have thought that we should have cross-party support on doing just that.
Well, what do you make of this? Because actually a lot of this is, local authorities are responsible, are they not?
There is a very important relationship between the local authorities and central government in this respect, particularly in all aspects of care. That's the way we identify and do first aid, as it were, in terms of finding problems, and how at the other end we actually try to cope with people that do not have the ability to look after themselves when they come out of when they come out of hospitals. It is very, very strange to me that the government sees these as two budgets. Although Bristol City Council is now responsible for health and well-being of public care, we're not really feeding back into that process and making the best out of it.
Okay, Anthony, I have to cut you short there. Time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests there, Conservative. No.
Absolutely.
God, I'm sorry,
not.
No. I don't know why that's written down here. Sorry about that. Lib Deb councillor for Cotham, Anthony Negus, back after the news.
National News on the Hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.